Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The House is voting on the $2 trillion relief bill as we speak, but there might be a problem. The New York Times reports that Republican Representative Thomas Massey of Kentucky said that he would insist on a recorded vote or delay its passage. We will get the latest. And then we'll talk about a new ProPublica investigation about how Walmart was almost charged criminally over opioids, and then Trump appointees killed the indictment. Jesse Eisinger and his colleague James Bandler wrote that piece. Jesse Eisinger is a senior reporter and editor of ProPublica. He is the author of The Chicken, S-H-I-T Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Hi, Jesse. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
Well, it's great to have you back, Jesse, and we're going to talk about your Walmart investigation in just a couple minutes, but I first want to ask you about this $2 trillion, 880-page stimulus package. I was just watching House members give 30-second arguments in favor of it. Let's just talk about this for a minute, because we've been talking all week about the financial help that this will provide for people, including luckily gig workers and people who are self-employed. It'll also help industries impacted by COVID-19. But I wanted to ask you about a piece from the New York Times by Jesse Drucker, and you tweeted about this morning. This piece is about how real estate investors will greatly benefit from it. According to the New York Times and this piece, Republicans inserted a provision on page 230, and it will hand $170 billion in tax savings to real estate tycoons.
Yes, Jesse Drucker's a great reporter and a good friend of mine, actually, he's a real tax expert. You know, the point of this is that in this massive rescue package stimulus bill that is necessary, and it's necessary to help workers, it's necessary to help average Americans, and it's necessary to, I think, give a kind of bridge of help to corporations, although that's debatable kind of what form it takes. There are going to be a massive number of goodies tucked into this for select industries, and Jesse Drucker found one of them, which is the extension of this kind of technique for commercial real estate that allows you to, it's very complicated, but the upshot is that it allows you to take manufactured losses by depreciating your assets over time, even though the assets are actually appreciating, actually improving in value, getting more valuable. And then you take a tax break on those. It's a game. It's a game that's gone on for a long time. It's a game why Jared Kushner probably pays little to no federal taxes, but it's now extended. So we're going to, at ProPublica, going to keep an eye on all these things. We have a team assembled to try to report on cronyism, on self-dealing, on the goodies for certain industries, what kind of lobbying went on for the package. But this was a great little story from my colleague over at the Times.
Yeah, it's such an important piece. And I mean, Jesse, people needed relief weeks ago. And, you know, bills are due. I can't even remember what day it is right now. So it's March 27th. April 1st is next Wednesday. And a wide range of bills are due for everyone across the country.
Yeah, there's no question. This is a cataclysm. I'm just still stunned that we're going through a generational catastrophe, an economic and financial catastrophe, once in a generation type of thing for the second time in a little over a decade. And last time around, we aided a lot of large banks and we really did not bail out homeowners. This time around, they are rectifying that a little bit, largely due to Democrats pushing for this in the House. But the money is not going to go to a lot of people quickly. If you don't have an IRS account, there's going to be a logistical challenge getting you cash. There's inevitable pain here, and the government is stepping up, and this is a time where certain people are recognizing the importance of collective action and of government, but we need these things to move more quickly, and we'll be watching to see if these programs actually are rolled out effectively and efficiently and quickly, and as anybody's familiar with government programs, often they are not.
And one more question on this, Jesse. Since you covered the 2008 financial crisis, how does this compare, given all the books that have been written about the mistakes and just not what we know now?
Well, the crisis has very different in that, the 2008 crisis was a credit crisis that was born of extraordinarily irresponsible behavior. This was the kind of, classic act of God that is foreseeable in a kind of general way, but we couldn't foresee that this would have happened at this time, coronavirus, in this moment. But there are a lot of similarities in that corporations have been extraordinarily irresponsible. They've run up a huge amount of debt. They've bought back their stock with their free cash flow and pumped up the returns to the executives and executive compensation. They haven't really raised wages. They didn't do a lot of investment. And now you have a lot of vulnerable companies. And an economy that hits a cataclysm, that can't be really predicted. But an economy that hits a cataclysm and then in 2 or 3 weeks is extraordinarily fragile because most people don't have savings and most companies can't weather 3 weeks. That's something structural. That's something that needs to be kind of addressed. And so I think that's really where the similarity to the 2008 financial crisis comes from, which is that it was revealed that our economy was an extraordinarily fragile thing structurally with terrible inequality and few regulations to no regulations of major corporations, and really no security. And it's been revealed again, and we're going to see whether this ends up being a kind of corporate bailout that doesn't do anything to rectify the structure of the economy and the equity of our economy. And I think that's where we're headed, where we're going to just kind of rebuild things the way they were before.
Well, if you are a small business owner, Congresswoman Barbara Lee from Oakland is hosting a town hall tonight at 6 p.m. to talk about resources available for small businesses. And the number to join, you don't need an access code, is 866-757-0660. 866-757-0660. This is tonight at 6 p.m. Pacific. You can also email us and we'll send you the information. Your call at kalw.org. Jesse Eisinger and his colleague James Bandler wrote a very significant story in ProPublica. And if it weren't for COVID-19, this would probably be getting a lot more attention. So we thought it was important, and we wanted to bring Jesse on to talk about it. It's called "Walmart Was Almost Charged Criminally Over Opioids. Trump Appointees Killed the Indictment." Jesse, this is really an incredible story. How and when did you find out about this?
Thank you. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate the attention amid coronavirus. I found out about it a few weeks ago when some people got in touch with me about it. It kind of came together as these things go relatively quickly.
Well, let me just read the lead here. You write, on a Tuesday just before Halloween in 2018, a group of federal prosecutors and agents from Texas arrived in Washington. For almost 2 years, they'd been investigating the opioid dispensing practices of Walmart, the largest company in the world. They had amassed what they viewed as highly damning evidence, only to face a major obstacle: top Trump appointees at the Department of Justice. Wow. Well, let's first talk about what they were investigating. What was happening at Walmart?
Sure. Well, this is a federal investigation by the DEA and federal prosecutors in the Eastern District of Texas, which is an office of the Department of Justice. And what they were investigating was Walmart operates a pharmacy, a giant pharmacy. It generates about $20 billion in revenue. It's the fifth largest pharmacy chain in the country. And their pharmacists dispense huge numbers of opioids. What these federal prosecutors were doing was they were tracking some pill mill doctors in Texas, very bad guys who were really dispensing huge amounts of opioids and actually led to patients' deaths. And one of them is serving 20 years in prison, the other is serving 10 years in prison. But they wanted to treat this investigation like any normal drug investigation. The prosecutor who was leading it was used to prosecuting drug cartels. She wanted to cut off the source of the drug. And one of the main sources was Walmart. And what they realized was that Walmart didn't really have any practices to limit opioids, but it was actually, over the course of the investigation, much worse. What they found was that their pharmacists were very alarmed about prescriptions that were coming in from doctors. And they would tell headquarters, look, I don't want to fill this prescription. I'm worried this guy is a pill mill doctor. And this was not just happening in Texas, but this was happening in states all over the country. It was a nationwide problem. There was one Florida doctor who was sending patients from Kentucky to Walmarts in central Wisconsin. And that Florida doctor was sending patients to Walmarts in over 30 states. And what these pharmacists were doing was they're saying, help us. We need practices. We need to restrict these prescriptions. And the compliance department, the department that was officially in charge of complying with the laws on controlled substances, on limiting opioid prescriptions, they were basically ignoring these pleas for help. They were saying, you need to participate in sort of bureaucratic practices and only look at each individual prescription on a case-by-case basis. But you can't just block a doctor. If you think he's a pill mill doctor, you have to look at each prescription. And doing that threw up this big hurdle, this big bureaucratic hurdle for these pharmacists. It would take them 20 minutes to fill out this thing, and they were under this pressure to fill prescriptions and generate revenue. And so they got this. Instead of being helped by the National Compliance Department, the National Compliance Department was, in the view of the prosecutors, burying their heads in the sand, looking the other way, and pushing these pharmacists to fill these bad prescriptions.
What are the procedures in place, Jesse, for these pharmacists who are pleading for help and guidance from Walmart's corporate office? Who did they talk to, and can you just give us a sense of how that works?
Yes. So the pharmacist sees a prescription as a bad prescription, and they go to the compliance department. There's a division within this giant compliance department. You can imagine that Walmart, which has over $500 billion in revenue and 2 million employees, has a giant compliance department. But a very important aspect is for health and wellness to cover this very thing, like what you're supposed to do about opioids. Because opioids are a controlled substance, it is illegal for a pharmacist to fill a prescription that is not for a legitimate medical purpose. That's against the law, and they can go to prison for that. And they understand that. And so they were saying, this is a liability. I'm worried about this prescription. I'm worried about this doctor. And I'm worried for Walmart, and I'm worried for myself. So they were doing the right thing in sending this up to compliance. But the compliance officials were saying there are two ways that they could have dealt with it. One way is they could have said, okay, you pharmacist Joe Blow in McKinney, Texas, you can blanket refuse this bad doctor. Whenever a prescription comes in, you could just refuse to fill any of his prescriptions. But they said, actually, you can't do that. The other thing they could have done is they could have said in the national headquarters, they could have said, okay, Joe, this doctor from McKinney, Texas, Dr. Jones, we're going to block him from the corporate level. No Walmart pharmacy across the country will fill his prescription. That's called a corporate block. They didn't do either of those two things. Instead, what they said to the pharmacists were, don't you can't block them. You can't refuse to fill those guys. We're not going to block them from the corporation. You can evaluate this on a case-by-case basis, and if you're troubled with by a prescription, then fill out this form. And this form took 20 minutes to fill out, and then when you fill out the form, we're going to send it to the DEA. So they did do that on occasion, but they weren't stopping those doctors. So even after getting warned about pill mill doctors, they were filling literally millions of doses of opioids after that for these bad doctors.
Wow. Jesse, in your story, you do name a few of the doctors. The case against Walmart originated in the summer of 2016 with an investigation of two Texas doctors, Howard Diamond and Randall Wade. They were prescribing opioids on a vast scale. So a couple of questions about these docs. First off, how did they benefit from this? More patients, kickbacks from Big Pharma?
Well, so the doctors themselves were just getting paid on a prescription basis. You know, they're getting paid to get see visits, see patients, and so that's the benefit for them. And you know, they had a very good operation going because they were operating pill mills. So that's the way they benefit. And then if they go to Walmart, Walmart gets gets a portion of the prescription too. As you know, it's not a high margin business, but it's a profitable business, and it's not a intensive business. You've got some compliance, but otherwise, you're just a middleman. So everybody's making money on this. There was no evidence, I should underscore, of collusion or illegal kickbacks or any funds going from the doctors to Walmart pharmacists or patients going to Walmart pharmacists. That was actually one of the key defenses that Walmart had, was we didn't commit crimes because there were no illegal payments. But that wasn't really the argument from the prosecutors anyway, so that was not really relevant.
Are those doctors still practicing today?
No, those guys are in prison. Diamond and Wade are serving 20 years and 10 years in prison because in part because their prescriptions led to patients' deaths. You know, as I say, Diamond and Wade were the way that these federal prosecutors and DEA agents started the prosecution, or started the investigation of Walmart, but they soon found that this was a national problem, which really led them to this extraordinary conclusion that the company itself should be indicted. And then, as we alluded to earlier, Trump top officials of the DOJ blocked it.
What about other doctors? If these two guys are in prison, what about other doctors that are prescribing opioids, specifically for Walmart?
What happened was Walmart improved its oversight after the investigation started. One of the arguments that Walmart had was, look, we're so much better now. We're really restricting opioids. We're policing this better. We're trying to limit these prescriptions. And you can imagine that Walmart has an enormous amount of analytics and data on prescribing practices nationally. So they can see a huge amount of information that an individual pharmacist can't see. And then the country as a whole has gotten much more conscious about prescribing practices around opioids as well. And so this is the bad activity is in the period of sort of 2011 to 2000, goes up to about 2016. The investigation starts in late 2016, and immediately Walmart starts to engage in much more responsible behavior in their reform efforts. And one of the reasons why the prosecutors were so skeptical of that was that they were sort of, Walmart was saying, look, we're so much better about this. We're so good. And they thought, you know, well, everybody finds Jesus in that when you're in jail, every defendant. But that doesn't mean that you get absolved for the crimes that you committed before you found Jesus.
Today we're speaking with Jesse Eisinger. Jesse is a senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. He's the author of The Chicken, SHIT Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Jesse and his colleague James Bandler wrote this new piece for ProPublica. Walmart was almost charged criminally over opioids. Trump appointees killed the indictment. They write, even as company pharmacists protested, Walmart kept filling suspicious prescriptions, stoking the country's opioid epidemic. A Republican U.S. attorney in Texas thought the evidence was damning. Trump's political appointees, not so much. So let's talk about how this unfolded, Jesse. You write that the DOJ's prosecution team had come to Washington to try to save the case. Joe Brown, the U.S. attorney, I'm sorry, that's not right. The Trump appointees at the DOJ quashed the case. And then you write, the prosecution team had come to Washington to try to save its case. Joe Brown, the U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Texas, led the group, which included Heather Ratten, an over 20-year veteran of the office who had spent much of her career prosecuting members of drug cartels. So lay out what exactly happened here.
Yeah, sure. So this pivotal meeting with Rod Rosenstein, there was a lot of build-up to the meeting, but the main point is that Joe Brown, who is actually a Trump appointee, Republican, okayed Heather Ratten's indictment of Walmart, and then what's known as main justice, or the front office, the political appointees in Washington, D.C., Trump appointees, blocked that indictment of Walmart. And so they asked for a meeting with Rod Rosenstein, who was then the deputy attorney general, obviously very famous from the Mueller investigation. And they had a meeting to discuss the investigation in October of 2018. The criminal indictment had already been blocked, but they sort of felt like they could revive the criminal indictment, or they could at least be able to go forward either with a civil investigation of the company, because they thought that Walmart had tens of billions of dollars of liability here, or prosecuting some individual executives. So they got into the meeting, and the acting administrator of the DEA is in this meeting too. And I spoke to five people who were very familiar with the investigation, so this is all confirmed by multiple people. And Dylan says, a fine is not going to be sufficient deterrent for Walmart. They have more money than they know what to do with. And Rosenstein, who is not buying any of this, sat back and said, not that there's anything wrong with that. We're all capitalists here. And what the prosecutors took from that was that he thought that they were, he was implying that they were sort of seeking to punish Walmart because it was a wealthy corporation or because it was profitable and not because of the bad behavior. You know, these are not East Coast liberals. They're not, they're not lefties. They were not seeking to punish a company because of its success. They were seeking to punish a company because they believed it had a hand in poisoning Americans.
Jesse, does this go to the very top of Walmart? Were high level executives involved in this, knowing what was happening in their stores?
Well, this is one of the extraordinary aspects of this, which is that what they prosecutors did was sensibly subpoena Walmart, and one of the things they subpoenaed Walmart for were emails from the compliance department up the chain, up to the senior executives, all the way to Doug McMillon, who is the CEO of the company, because what they wanted to know is, what did the top executives know? And Walmart did not cooperate with the subpoena. They did not give these emails, and they said it was kind of too onerous to deliver this, too extraneous, it was not fair to be asked for this. And it was so frustrating and so really kind of outrageous to the prosecutors that their subpoena wasn't being complied with, that they discussed this with the top officials in Washington, the Trump officials, Trump appointees, and the Trump appointees were kind of taken aback. Why would you be asking for these kind of emails? Why would you be looking at what the CEO knew? So that was the first thing that was very bizarre. The second thing was that when the prosecutor said, look, Our subpoena is not being complied with. They're not fully cooperating with this investigation. We have to go to court to get a judge to enforce our subpoena. That got blocked. The Trump appointees at the DOJ blocked their desire, their effort, their willingness to go to court to defend their subpoena. So I think that was one of the most extraordinary damning aspects of what we found, was that Walmart was able to ignore a federal subpoena, and when the prosecutors sought to enforce it, Trump officials quashed that.
Before we let you go, Jesse, you report that Walmart seems to have obviously benefited from the Trump administration's approach to corporate misconduct. You also write that the Trump DOJ has pulled back on white-collar and corporate investigations and prosecutions. White-collar prosecutions are at a record low. So you have to wonder, what other big stories are out there just waiting to be written?
I would write all of them if I could. If you know of one, get in touch with us at ProPublica. But yes, this is the best time to be a corporate criminal in recent American history. White-collar prosecutions are at a record low. They were not very good under the Obama administration. My book is highly critical of the Obama administration's approach to white-collar crime and the lack of prosecutions of top executives. But this is a whole order of magnitude worse now. It's the worst, you know, in modern times. So the Trump administration is interested in doing kind of low-level drug enforcement. It's interested in prosecuting immigration crimes. It's not interested in corporate crime or white-collar crime to any significant degree.
Well, it also raises questions, Jesse, now that we are all so focused on COVID-19, as we should be, we're missing a lot of really important stories.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, it's inevitable. This is a genuine cataclysm. It's not like this is a trivial problem, both a health crisis and an economic and financial crisis. But this is going to be, going back to the top of our conversation, it's going to be an opportunity for not only for corporate criminals to get away with things, but they're going to seek extraordinary exemptions from regulation. They're going to seek a rollback of federal rules. And so, you know, we're going to try to focus on that at ProPublica, focus on what kind of rules get rolled back and what the consequences for average Americans of those rules to their health and safety and labor protections and, you know, and the financial stability of the country will be. We don't know that yet, but that's something, fortunately, that we have the resources to try to track, unfortunately, as people are so understandably absorbed by the financial, economic, and health crisis we're living in, they're not going to really be paying attention to what's going on.
Well, that is why you are there, Jesse. Thank you for all of your work. Thanks to all of your colleagues.
Thank you. I really appreciate the time here.
Well, thanks again. Jesse Eisinger and his colleague James Brandler wrote the piece, "Walmart was almost charged criminally over opioids. Trump appointees killed the indictment." And, well, we're all home right now, hopefully the majority of us. And so if you have some time over the weekend, you can read this lengthy piece, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. Jesse is the author of The Chicken SHIT Club, Why the Justice Department Fails to Prosecute Executives. Coming up after a break, we'll be joined by Anna Maria Berry-Jesser with Kaiser Health News, and we'll be talking about how California frontline workers are preparing for COVID-19 patients. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. And you can post a comment or question on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A from WAMU in Washington and a further roundup of the week's news. Stay with us here on KALW.
Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about how California's frontline healthcare workers are preparing for more COVID-19 patients. According to the San Francisco Chronicle's tracker, there are now 4,033 confirmed cases in California. Tragically, 83 people have died. And joining us to talk about the latest is Anna Maria Berry Jester, a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Anna Maria focuses on disparities, public health, and healthcare. Hi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just want to talk about a recent Los Angeles Times story to put some of this in perspective. California's top medical advisor, Dr. Mark Galli, on Wednesday said that coronavirus cases in California are doubling every 3 to 4 days. This is a fast pace on par with New York, where we know that sadly, hospitals are completely overwhelmed. So, Anna Maria, just based on, you know, people you've been talking to, what are health officials expecting in the next 2 weeks in California?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the time frame for when they're sort of expecting a peak in cases varies a little bit depending on who you talk to. They're looking at sort of 2 to 3 weeks in the Bay Area. And they are expecting or preparing for the worst. Of course, everyone's hoping that the sort of strict shelter-in-place measures that the Bay Area put in ahead of the rest of the country are going to help in keeping the number of cases down. But as you said, there's some concern because the number of cases is doubling at a faster rate than people had hoped it might. Hospitals are doing a whole range of things. They've started by clearing out people from the hospital who maybe had less urgent needs and hopefully could be cared for outside of an ICU or the hospital so that they could make more beds available. They've been, you know, UCSF has created a sort of a triage system where everyone who comes into the hospital is screened for respiratory illness. And if they have any respiratory symptoms, they go to a separate tent and get a test before they're admitted to the hospital, unless, of course, they're severely ill and need to be immediately taken to the emergency room or an ICU bed. So there is a lot that's going on, but there's also a lot that is leaving a lot of physicians very concerned. There's a huge lack of protective equipment, and they are seeing a growing number of cases, though some hospitals have said they have not yet seen a huge number of people who need to be hospitalized, which they're hoping is a promising sign.
On Monday, Governor Gavin Newsom said California would be short about 17,000 hospital beds, raising his previous estimate of a 10,000-bed shortfall. He also said that California is short of hundreds of millions of masks. And then can we just talk about testing for a bit? Because this is really important. You know, we can read the numbers and, you know, thanks to all of the media outlets that have these trackers, but we really don't know how many people are infected because California is so far behind other states when it comes to testing. In fact, New York has tested about 3 times as many people as California. So, Anna Maria, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with testing in California.
Yeah, so maybe it's helpful to start talking about what that would look like in an ideal setting. So normally when you have a novel infection like this, you would have emergency use tests that would be deployed through public health labs around the country. And then those tests give you a sense of who has the virus, where they are. You can isolate those early cases, track those people down and the people they've had contact with, and hopefully slow the spread of disease. And in the interim, private labs, you know, design tests, get them approved by the FDA, and so you can expand diagnostic testing to your, you know, healthcare provider so that sort of anyone who needs a test can get one. And what's happened here, unfortunately, is that the original test created by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had a problem with one of the components. And so when it was rolled out, there was a long delay in being able to use it. And then there was also a really narrow testing protocol at the beginning that meant we weren't testing people who did, in fact, have the virus because they hadn't either traveled recently to Wuhan, China, where the outbreak began, or they weren't so sick that they were hospitalized and had contact with somebody known to have the disease. So we sort of missed some of that window early on to prevent some of the spread. Then once the test rolled out, there were have been a series of problems where they haven't been able to get enough swabs and enough of the materials that they need to actually run the test. So once that was clear that using the public health labs was going to be a problem and there were going to be lots of constraints, there was this massive effort to utilize private labs and academic labs so that we could have more testing. And that has happened, but it also comes with its own problems, so that we didn't have that kind of underlying information that you would normally hope to have to understand how many people have the virus and where. And private labs don't normally communicate directly to public health officials the number of tests that they're doing, and particularly not the negative tests. And so we're still scrambling to get even the sort of basic underlying information, in addition to having a very limited number of tests. And it is extremely frustrating for public health officials who are still kind of operating fairly blindly in terms of how much disease is out there and who has it. And that's part of the reason that they jumped so aggressively to these blanket shelter-in-place orders, because if you don't know where the virus is, you can't prevent it from being spread.
Right. And on Tuesday, the San Francisco Chronicle reported that health officials in six Bay Area counties banded together to issue an order that would require all private and university labs turn over the data so they can stitch it all together to give everyone a more comprehensive picture of the virus's impact on the entire region.
Yeah, that's right. And that's a really important step and will provide us a ton more information. But there is a real problem in that, and many health departments have told me this, you know, they don't have systems in place, and certainly not electronic systems, to gather this information from various labs, but also to understand things like how many people are hospitalized with COVID-19 at various hospitals. A lot of that work is being done, you know, over the phone on sort of a voluntary basis, in the sense that there's not a clear mechanism for, you know, these individual pieces of our fragmented health system to report to officials, which means that there's a very incomplete picture, which is part of the reason that even though there's some hope that the Bay Area has made some progress by having these aggressive shelter-in-place orders so soon, it's too soon to say, because we really are lacking a lot of very basic information.
Right. And as you report in one of your recent pieces, UCSF had to rely on the San Francisco Department of Public Health for testing until a few days ago, but then the situation improved. Stanford pathologist Benjamin Pinsky built an in-house test that has been approved by the FDA, and Stanford is now testing patients. And here also, for the very first time, there is a new drop-in testing site in Hayward, and KPIX reports that of the 207 people who got tested on Monday, 54 tested positive. According to reports, it's the only testing site in the state that does not require a doctor's referral, but you do have to have a fever of at least 100 degrees or difficulty breathing or shortness of breath. And Anna Maria, what's happening is once the word gets out about these testing centers, the lines are now so long that people in Hayward, and this is being run, thank you again, frontline workers, in this case it's firefighters who are paramedics, they have to turn people away because the lines are so long.
Yeah, that's right. And that's part of what's really challenging here, is there's the people you would test in an ideal world, right, which would be sort of anybody showing the symptoms who, you know, ostensibly you'd want to isolate, make sure that they're separated from anyone else and they don't, you know, don't contact other people and pass on the virus. But with the very limited tests, officials are asking to restrict who gets tested to people who are really sick and kind of need to be hospitalizable, or who are part of vulnerable populations. And that can be a lot of people. It can be people with compromised immune systems. It can be people who live in what they call congregant environments, which could be shelters or nursing facilities, places where it could easily spread very rapidly. But that's not, you know, ideally how this would work. Ideally, more people would be getting tested, but the testing is just so limited. And as you said, there are these places that are opening up, that they're trying to expand the testing capabilities, but that, as we were talking about, sort of creates this additional challenge of then trying to gather all that information together so that we can have a picture. So there's sort of the individual here, you know, those of us who are ill and really want to get a test and need to understand what our status is so that we can behave and, you know, respond accordingly. But then there's also the big picture public health where we also need that data and information to understand where we're at.
Right. And what we are hearing from public health officials is if you are experiencing any symptoms, you should contact your doctor. And if you do not have a doctor, you should contact your local public health department. Today, we are speaking with Anna Maria Berry-Jester, a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, where she focuses on health disparities, public health, and healthcare. If you have any questions or comments about this, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Anna Maria, we have an email from Jane who says, why hasn't the U.S. military been mobilized on this? We taxpayers are paying for this enormous machine, and I, for once, would like to see my money spent for the good of my fellow citizens and not causing murder and mayhem overseas. What can you tell us about this? I know that the National Guard is helping with food banks up and down the state of California because so many of the volunteers are older and they are staying home. And then we do have that ship that is going to be, I believe it may have already docked in Los Angeles, but can you give us any other sense of how the military is stepping up to help with all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So as you said, the National Guard has been engaged in several places. The Governor Newsom, as well as officials in other states, have been very clear that they are a force of aid, not a military force. I think public officials have been trying to convey the message that this is not a police state. I think there's been some concern among local officials that they wish there was a sort of a stronger hand helping them with enforcement of the shelter in place rules. But the military, you know, that one thing that maybe hasn't gotten talked about a lot is there are military installations all over the world in places where there are also outbreaks. And there's a lot of work going on in those places to keep soldiers who are deployed, particularly in South Korea and some other countries, safe. But as far as I know, and I don't cover the military, but as far as I know, there's not additional plans to deploy the military domestically.
Right. Well, thank you for that email. We're also getting some breaking news. I just got this from the LA Times. The House just approved the $2 trillion coronavirus rescue package. Objecting to one libertarian conservative from Kentucky, Representative Thomas Massie. He threatened to uphold the vote, but he failed. And so this bill has been proved now by the Senate and the House. Donald Trump has said that he will sign the bill immediately. And Anna Maria, I don't want to put you on the spot because this is not your beat, but have you been following anything in this bill and how it would affect hospitals and frontline workers?
I am not super familiar with the details, particularly as it's sort of changed over time as, you know, as the bill worked its way through Congress. So I can't really speak to the details, but I can say that, you know, what hospitals are looking for in terms of support, they need a lot more protective gear. And people are reusing equipment that normally is disposable for, you know, full days. They're using disinfectant wipes to try and clean them to keep themselves protected. They also need additional beds, as we talked about earlier, Governor Newsom saying that there seems to be a shortage of about 17,000 beds. And they are in need of things like ventilators. But there's also, you know, a whole range of other people in the healthcare system who are small businesses, right, like physicians and doctor's offices who right now are largely shut down. So I think that will impact, you know, some of the measures that are in there to help small businesses will actually be helpful for other parts of the healthcare system. But I'm not familiar with a lot of the details.
Right. Okay. And we'll definitely do a show about this next week. I know that so many people are waiting for financial relief, especially because so many bills are due next Wednesday. And so now that financial relief will be on its way. And we'll do a show about this on Tuesday to find out exactly how much is in this and what you can expect. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Dorothea in Berkeley. Hi, Dorothea. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for your show. I wanted to tell you about this problem of people being diagnosed and sent back into their households to contaminate everybody else. This happened to a friend of mine in Oakland. Her daughter lives with roommates, and one of the roommates was diagnosed positive, sent back home, and then her daughter returned home to her mom, who's in her 60s. So hoping for the best there, but this is the problem. Why aren't they putting people in isolation who've been diagnosed? And it's pretty clear we don't have 17,000 beds, doesn't sound like enough, and we don't have enough healthcare workers to help those people either. So I want you to talk about that a little bit. What's all right. the solution for that?
Yeah, this is such a good question, Dorothea. Thank you. Anna Maria?
Yeah, this is such a good point, and it was brought up to me by several emergency room physicians that I spoke with. We know from some of the data we have from China and some other countries that a lot of the transmission is among people who live together. It is the kind of the highest risk. You know, you're spending time touching the same surfaces, sharing the same bathrooms, that kind of thing, and it does pose a very serious risk. At this time, there are not a lot of good solutions for where people can go and isolate. There has been some effort to make hotel rooms available. There are many parts of the country where healthcare workers are being put up in hotels and Airbnbs and things like that so that they don't infect their own family members in the event that they've been, you know, exposed or are carrying the virus on their clothing, that kind of thing. But this is a really big concern. The physicians I talked to gave me some specific details on how people might try and protect themselves. Bathrooms are sort of the biggest concern area, and so you're supposed to try and either use separate bathrooms or really do a deep cleaning with bleach after every time that a person who's infected uses the bathroom. But as we all know, that's really challenging. Most of us live in households where there's, you know, far more people than bathrooms, and this is a very fair concern.
It is, and something really struck me a couple of weeks ago, Anna Maria. Donald McNeil, a health reporter for the New York Times, told Rachel Maddow that in China, families are separated once they test positive. He said that most people in China caught the virus at home, and officials quickly realized that they needed to separate families to limit exposure. So what they were doing there is they had the drive-through testing very quickly, and if you tested positive, people were either, I guess, asked to go to a hotel room, or they went into a large gymnasium so they would be separated from their families. But, I mean, that is just so incredibly difficult to do here.
Yeah, it's very different from the approach we're taking. I did speak with the health officer for San Francisco, and he said they are working on trying to rent out, procure up to, you know, thousands, ideally, of hotel rooms to try and start facilitating isolation. But it is a logistical challenge, and we frankly do not have the public health infrastructure that currently would allow us to do this on anything at scale. You know, I will say one positive development is a week ago, a physician at UCSF told me that they had somebody who was homeless and lived in a shelter, right? This is a very dangerous scenario for spreading the virus. And they were waiting on their results, and they did not have anywhere that they could send this person while they waited for the results. And so they were keeping them at the hospital, which was very unsustainable given the, you know, low number of beds that they had. Apparently this week that has changed, and there is a place that people can go while they wait. So there are efforts to improve this, but it is still really a challenge, and a lot of it's being left up to individuals, whereas normally under those circumstances there are public health officials who try and help with sort of this forced isolation. I really feel for these families.
Oh, yeah. And Representative Katie Porter, who's from Southern California, she took a test. Luckily, she's negative, but she said she was staying in a room. And then I was just reading from NBC Los Angeles, Dr. Timmy Chang is an Irvine critical care specialist, and he's basically camping out in his family's garage in a tent. And I've been hearing this from other frontline workers, that they're separating from their families by putting tents in their garages or other parts of the home.
Yeah, you can imagine the stress. I mean, in addition to what these frontline workers are doing, the nurses, the doctors, and the many other people who work in hospitals, you know, they're caring for patients. They're in these very high stress conditions. They're hearing the news. We're hearing that maybe the worst is yet to come. And then on top of that, they have to be separated from their families, which is very difficult. But for many of them, it feels like a necessity if they're going to protect their families and prevent the spread of the virus.
Right. And Anna Maria, we have a question from Greg. We don't have time to take your question, Greg, because we're almost out of time here. But he says construction workers everywhere are not social distancing, and then they go back to their homes and communities. Anna Maria, I mean, this applies to workers across the board. I went to 3 grocery stores to shop for family the other day, and it's almost impossible to social distance in a smaller grocery store. Instacart workers are going to go on strike on Monday because they feel like they're not getting the proper protection, and it's hard to social distance. So this applies to so many workers right now.
Yeah, there's several kinds of workers who've been designated essential and therefore, you know, are continuing work. Some construction work very much falls into that. Grocery stores, as you said, also farm work. There are a lot of people who are still at their jobs. And, you know, there's just a range of feelings among public health officials about this. On the one hand, they feel like it's really important to maintain access to food and those kinds of things. And on the other hand, it could be a source of transmission. And the one thing I will say is that in some other countries, including Italy and Spain, the feeling is that they didn't lock down fast enough and people were continuing to go out to places. Now, that was more restaurants and bars that they're concerned about. But, you know, in a few weeks, we will probably have a better understanding of the measures we've taken were appropriate.
Right. Well, thank you, Greg. And we're going to definitely do more shows about workers and farm workers in the coming weeks. A quick question from Stephen. I live in Marin County, and we've only tested at the last report is 627. Why is this number so small?
The number of tests is just extremely limited. It is shockingly limited. This is going to be something we talk about for years to come in the United States. But that is the case in a lot of parts of the state and all over the country where they're really only testing people who are already hospitalized, so sick that they're hospitalized. And that means that a lot of cases of people who are maybe not as sick but still quite ill and capable of spreading the virus are not being tested.
Well, Anna Maria, thank you so much for all of your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anna Maria Berry-Jester is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. You can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. I'm getting a couple of emails about Congresswoman Barbara Lee's teletown hall tonight. She is going to talk about resources for small businesses, and you do not need an access code. The phone number is 866-757-0660. It starts at 6 o'clock tonight, and this is for people in California. Again, 866-757-0660. You can always email us and we'll send you that number, yourcall@kalw.org. Sheila writes, I want to let you know that there's a call out to San Franciscans to come to their doors and windows tonight at 7 p.m. to applaud and holler and bang pots and pans in appreciation of our healthcare workers on the front lines. This has been happening in other countries, so thank you so much for that, Sheila. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. David LaTulipe, our studio engineer. Thank you, David, for answering the phones. And thank you so much for joining us. We're always here for you if you have a show idea. Your call at kalw.org. Thanks for listening and joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.